This is Central Time. The Great Recession had a big impact on the housing market in Milwaukee, among many other cities. Earlier this month, we talked to Mike Goucher from Marquette's Law School about a new report they released looking at Milwaukee's housing over the last 15 years. Some of the key findings we talked about were a dramatic decline, a drop in home ownership in Milwaukee by people who actually live there, and a major transfer of ownership to landlords outside the city, even outside of the state. We wanted to know more about who's been buying these homes around the country, so we reached back out to Aaron Glantz. Aaron is a senior reporter for the Center for Investigative Reporting. We talked to him previously about his book, Home Wreckers: How a Gang of Wall Street Kingpins, Hedge Fund Magnates, Crooked Banks, and Vulture Capitalists Suckered Millions Out of Their Homes and Demolished the American Dream. Aaron, welcome back to Central Time.
Oh, it's good to be with you.
Well, we learned these stats when we talked to Mike Goucher from Marquette Law School and their Milwaukee Area Project. Findings that include that $580 million worth of residential property is owned by out-of-state landlords in Milwaukee. That's a big increase, $400 million increase over 15 years or so. This, I imagine, based on your book and your research, not a surprise to you.
This is part of a national trend. There's now there's nearly 3 million homes and more than 10 million apartments across America that are now owned by LLC, LLP, and LP shell companies, where if you go to the county recorder, you can't even find out who the real owner is. There's been a generational transfer of wealth from families to not only landlords, but this new type of landlord, which is really hidden from the public view.
What happened? What led to this new market, I guess, for these companies to snap up, in many cases, single-family homes and do this all over the country?
Well, what we saw in the housing bust was 8 million Americans lost their homes. Generations of wealth were wiped out all across America. And if we lived in a true kind of virtuous capitalist society, what we might have seen is when prices came down, other families might have been able to buy these homes. And maybe, you know, some people would argue, well, some of those 8 million families should have never taken out that mortgage, but there's going to be other people who, you know, were being thrifty and saving and would be well positioned to buy at this lower price point. But what happened was the government intervened to help the speculators. The banks got a huge bailout, but they weren't lending. And so the government ended up owning tons of property because we were backing up these mortgages. And what the government did then was it bundled them and sold them off in bulk to large private equity and Wall Street firms. And that led to this whole market where, people are buying and selling and trading property at a high level before you or I or any other family can even take a look at it.
What do we know about these companies that, as you say, can be kind of invisible from their LLC or whatever name? Who are they really?
Well, in my book, I looked at a slice of these guys. Blackstone, for example, the world's largest private equity firm, or one of them, buying up 80,000 homes all across the country. This is a firm that was is still headed by Steve Schwarzman, who's a good friend of the president. Tom Barrack, the president's best friend, who introduced Ivanka at the Republican convention, he built up an empire of 30,000 homes using shell companies. B. Wayne Hughes, the founder of Public Storage, he built up a whole empire of single-family homes. Importantly, though, Barrack and Schwarzman, they've both sold out. You know, they're Wall Street flippers, so they're no longer heading these companies. They're now publicly traded companies on the stock market that even your listeners could buy into. But also importantly, most of these big national players do not prefer cities like Milwaukee. They don't like old construction. They don't like winter, because winter means higher maintenance bills. They tend to prefer cities like Las Vegas or Phoenix or Atlanta with a newer housing stock and gentler weather. And so my guess is that in the Milwaukee area, a lot of what you're seeing is more regional speculators than these big national players that I wrote about in Homewreckers.
What does it mean for a community, a neighborhood, if we go from a state, say, 12 years ago, where many of these houses were owner-occupied or maybe rented by a local landlord who owns a few houses, to this huge growth in the percentage of these houses owned by outside the city or outside the state speculators?
It's a huge, huge impact. I mean, Milwaukee has lost 16,000 homeowners over the last decade, just the Milwaukee area. And then across the state of Wisconsin, you're looking at a drop as well. And as we've seen these houses go from being owned by individual homes to large corporations, there are so many different things that can happen. Some of them, you might have blighted and empty properties. Some of them, you might have companies that are not paying their property tax, but the county can't figure out, you know, where to find the person who's delinquent because the person is a corporate shell. Tenants, if their plumbing breaks or their windows break, may not be able to get to their landlord if the property management company doesn't respond well to them. Here in the Bay Area, where I'm talking to you from, in Oakland, we just had a housing occupation. There were these homeless moms who went into a perfectly good house in West Oakland that had been bought up by an LLC speculator that was just leaving the home vacant so that, you know, presumably it would appreciate in value and then they could sell it to somebody else. At the same time, we have a horrible homeless problem here. So we look around and we ask ourselves, do we have enough housing? Do we need more housing? We also need to be asking ourselves, who owns the housing that we do have and what are they doing with it?
Talking to Aaron Glantz from the Center for Investigative Reporting, author of the book Homewreckers, How a Gang of Wall Street Kingpins, Hedge Fund Magnates, Crooked Banks, and Vulture Capitalists Suckered Millions Out of Their Homes and Demolished the American Dream. We're talking about a rise in the number of out-of-state owners of individual single-family houses and other small housing units. Milwaukee saw a huge jump. Milwaukee not alone across the country. Aaron, in the run-up to the Great Recession, I know a big part of the story was people on Wall Street taking all these mortgage securities, coming up with these exotic investment schemes built around them, and it ended up being this house of cards. Is something like that, some kind of weird mortgage securitization happening now with, or something like it, happening with these vast changes of property in cities like Milwaukee and others?
One of the things that we've seen is as property is concentrating in these large corporate landlords, the landlords are bundling the homes and leveraging them, and they are creating their own mortgage-backed securities. So I wrote in my book about this home in Southern California that had been owned for more than 30 years by a family. Sandy Jolly's family is a 1,500 square foot home, two bedrooms, one bathroom, a little patch of lawn, and a lemon tree out front, like the kind of home that you would find in cities all across America and all across Wisconsin. And it was foreclosed on during the housing bust by Steve Mnuchin's bank, and then it was sold on the courthouse steps to a company run by Tom Barrack, Donald Trump's best friend. And then Sandy, the woman who had been living in it, her parents had bought this house for under $90,000 back in the 80s. She ended up paying more than $40,000 in rent to rent that same house from this out-of-state corporate landlord. But to your question, that didn't end the story, because what the corporate landlord did then was it bundled this house that had been in this family for generation, and it put it together with about 1,000 other homes. And it took out a $500 million loan against the entire bundle, which the tenants who are living in all of those homes are now paying back. And as property values have gone up since then, this first $500 million loan was in 2014. The house has actually been leveraged two more times, and it's now in a $1 billion mortgage-backed security that was taken out with Deutsche Bank. And so the tenants who are living in all of these homes now are paying out this $1 billion loan that the corporate landlord has taken off. So the best case scenario is that we have a generational transfer of wealth from all of these tenants to this corporate landlord. The worst case scenario is that property values go down like they did in the housing bust. The $1 billion security fails, and we're on our way to another great recession.
Now, if I, Aaron, go out driving in these neighborhoods, it's not going to look any different than it did 10 or 12 years ago. This seismic change is happening kind of invisibly. Do you see, as you've been reporting on this and talking to people in local areas, do you see mayors, community leaders, anybody else taking notice and raising this as a problem?
I do. I think that this is an increasing concern to people. And in December, the Center for Investigative Reporting, where I work, we sued the Treasury Department to try to get a handle on who is behind these 3 million homes and 10 million apartment units all around America that are owned by shell companies. I learned through my reporting the Treasury Department is keeping this data. We filed a Freedom of Information Act request. The Treasury Department denied us, so we went to court. And after we went to court, I started to hear from local officials all around the country, also law professors in cities all around the country, community groups, housing advocates. They all want to know the answer to the same question, which is who is buying up America? Because if they cannot have the answer to this very basic question, they cannot make policy. And even if the neighborhood might look very similar, the impact on the community is significant. We live in a country right now where the unemployment rate is very low and the stock market is doing quite well, but people just feel like they're barely holding on. And the reason for that is that they used to own something. They used to have equity. They used to have a stake in the system and a foothold in their neighborhood. And now they're paying rent to these more and more distant landlords, and they feel like they're just barely holding on.
If I'm a, say, mayor, and then I see this going on and I don't like it, is there any recourse? No laws, as I understand it here, are being broken. Under current law, these companies can do this.
Yeah, at the way the law is written right now. But if you're a mayor or a local official, remember that property is a local issue. Right. I mean, Congress could intervene and Congress could require additional levels of disclosure and transparency. But all of this disclosure traditionally has happened at the local level. So Washington, D.C., for example, the local Washington, D.C., recently passed a rule that said if you buy a property with an LLC company, you need to disclose who the owner is to Washington, D.C. There'd be nothing stopping Milwaukee or Madison or anywhere else from passing a similar law. And then, your government there could start to ask some questions like, you know, are we looking at, let's say there's 100 properties bought by shell companies. Are we looking at one owner buying 100 properties, or are we looking at 100 different people buying properties using shell companies? Depending on what the answer to that question is, the policy fix could be different. But it starts with disclosure.
Aaron, thanks a lot for joining us today.
All right. Thank you.
That was Aaron Glantz, senior reporter for the Center for Investigative Reporting, author of the book Home Wreckers. We talked to him today to learn more about who's behind a drop in owner occupancy rates in Milwaukee and the rise in out-of-state ownership of single-family houses. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Roger Stone, an associate of President Trump's, was sentenced to just over 3 years in prison today and a fine of $20,000 for lying to Congress about his contacts with WikiLeaks and for intimidating a witness. Four prosecutors withdrew from the case last week after the Justice Department overruled the recommendation of a sentence of 7 to 9 years for Stone. Before and since, President Trump has been talking about the case and criticizing Judge Amy Berman Jackson on Twitter. And today, Trump says he wants to see Stone exonerated but doesn't plan to pardon him at the moment. This all spurred a group called the Federal Judges Association to call an emergency meeting. The group has postponed that meeting, but the last week leaves some big questions about divisions between the president, the courts, and the Department of Justice in criminal cases. Vikram Amar is the dean of the College of Law and a professor at the University of Illinois. He's author of several books on constitutional law. Vikram, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Well, a lot of eyes on the actual sentence today, but a lot of the story came in the week leading up to it. What did you make of the president's tweets really weighing in very directly on the possible sentence and the sentencing recommendations for Roger Stone?
Well, I think it points up an important but underappreciated reality about our constitutional structure, and that is that a lot of things that we have taken for granted in the last several decades about the independence of the Department of Justice and the hands-off approach that modern presidents have tended to take to criminal law enforcement, that these norms may be really good ideas, they may be wise, prudent things, but they're not constitutionally mandated. The president, as a constitutional matter, does sit atop the executive branch hierarchy. The FBI is part of the Department of Justice. The Department of Justice is headed by the Attorney General. The Attorney General is the president's appointee. So presidents are, you know, whether we like it or not, they are the investigator-in-chief and the prosecutor-in-chief and the partner-in-chief and the declassifier-in-chief. The president, a lot of what he does is kind of blatantly disregarding norms that have built up, especially since Watergate in the 70s. But that's not the same thing as violating the Constitution per se. Now, if he's doing things for improper, illicit motives, then that can stray over into a constitutional violation. But as we saw from the Russian interference investigation, or the impeachment episode involving Ukraine, or the census case where the Department of Justice, or excuse me, the administration was asking questions about citizenship on the census, or the so-called travel ban case, it's really hard in formal judicial arenas to find improper intent, which is why it's really going to be up to the people come November to decide whether they think this president is doing the right thing or not.
I want to give a listen to President Trump speaking along these lines about whether he has the power to intercede. Here's a listen.
No, I didn't speak to the judge. I'd be able to do it if I wanted. I have the absolute right to do it. I stay out of things to a degree that people wouldn't believe, but I didn't speak to him. I thought the recommendation was ridiculous.
So Trump's saying he has the absolute right to talk to the attorney general about these sentencing recommendations. For what you were just saying, he does, in fact, as president, have that right.
Yeah, so let me give you an example. Let's imagine that when President Trump took office, the Department of Justice investigations into Senator Hillary Clinton's emails was still ongoing. Her careless use of the emails, where the DOJ was still investigating whether that violated any federal crimes. And let's imagine a very different world in which Trump comes into office and he decides whether or not Ms. Clinton violated federal law. It would just serve the country to put this behind us. Let's heal. Let's come together. Let's reach across party lines. So he directs his attorney general and his head of his FBI to kill the investigation, no matter what the outcome would have been, whether or not there was something there that could have been indicted and ordinarily prosecuted. No one in the world would say a president doesn't have the power to do that. And the reason that would have been an example of something relatively unobjectionable is because we would have all known that he was doing it for laudable reasons. Maybe we might disagree with him or not, but those were not improper, illicit, overly personal motives. The problem is when you interfere or you weigh in when it's your crony or your advisor or your friend or your campaign associates, as in the case of the Russian investigation, then it raises the question that the specter that you're not intervening because of your sense of what justice requires, but for crass personal reasons. This, of course, was at the heart of the impeachment episode. The quid pro quos are not a problem generically. Every contract that all of us enter into is a quid pro quo. The question is, why was he insisting on Ukraine doing things before the aid was released? Was it because he really did care about corruption? Well, whether he's right or wrong about that, if that's his actual motive, that's okay. But if instead it was only to wound a political opponent, that's a different situation. So the president is doing a lot of things that the presidents have the power to do, but he's doing them under circumstances that lead a lot of people to believe he's doing them for improper, illicit reasons. And it's just really hard to prove that.
if we're only counting on norms to stop that kind of behavior, stepping back from whether President Trump is in the right or wrong on these issues, take a hypothetical future president who wanted to clearly behave in the wrong on day one they came into office. It sounds like the norms themselves wouldn't stop them, and the Constitution wouldn't necessarily stop them either.
Well, the Constitution would stop them to the extent that a president is doing things that the American people are so upset with that you can get a supermajority in Congress to investigate and impeach and convict, or at least threaten conviction to get the president to stop. So the reason presidents don't stop is because they know in today's world it's really hard to get 67 senators to get rid of them, and it's hard to get even close enough to that there's any credible threats. Congress doesn't have very many arrows in its quill when we live in this partisan world where no one is going to cross party lines against a president of his or her own party. So at the end of the day, when you can't get a bipartisan supermajority together because we live in extremely striven times, or when the conduct is just not quite obviously bad enough that the American people are up in arms, then the only big check you have is investigation and education of the American people, which is what the House of Representatives will continue to do over the next several months, leading into an election where a president, or at least his party, is going to have to account to answer to the American people.
Talking to Vikram Amar, Dean of the College of Law and professor at the University of Illinois, looking at the relationship between the president, the Department of Justice, the judicial system itself. Vikram, a lot of these cases center around alleged efforts to interfere with elections. The 2016 concerns about 2020, if our only realistic tool is voting someone out of office, and the crime they're accused of is trying to manipulate things in their favor in that election, that's the only way that can be held accountable. Is that a problem?
Yeah, that is a problem. I mean, it's a very subtle point that you raise. And, you know, I would like it if members of Congress and the American public were sensitive to that that tension you just identified, and take that into account when they consider crossing party lines, either in an impeachment setting or come the election next fall. Again, blatant election manipulation should be captured by legal processes. But what we've had so far are actions that are consistent with election manipulation, but they're also consistent with other objectives. And it's really, really hard for courts or the Senate, sitting as a court of impeachment, to invalidate an otherwise permissible presidential exercise of power on the ground that, well, this is ordinarily an okay thing for a president to do, but you did it for the wrong reason. In American history, we just don't have a tradition where courts or court-like bodies are the ones to make those determinations of what's in someone's mind or in someone's heart. And that's why ultimately, I'm not entirely satisfied to say this, but we have to trust the American people.
Is it a systemic flaw that the main organizations that investigate crimes at the federal level are under the authority, the constitutional authority of the chief officer, the chief executive officer of the federal government, that if they want to do crimes, they can effectively quash investigations of those crimes?
Well, you know, that's exactly the question that people asked after Watergate that led to the enactment of the so-called independent counsel statute. We no longer have that statute on the books. But remember, Ken Starr was not under the thumbs of the Department of Justice, because once he was appointed, he had a statute that guaranteed him independence. And so he could basically go after high-level executive officials, including President Clinton himself, free from political control. Now, most people, myself included, think that didn't work out so well. The only thing worse than having investigators who are beholden to the president might be having investigators that are beholden to nobody, as Ken Starr was. Let's go back to Watergate. In Watergate, things worked the way they should have. They were messy, but ultimately, when Richard Nixon and his inner circle were accused of wrongdoing, the media, together with the American people, together with some members of Congress, all came together to tell him, look, the jig is up, and unless you resign, you're going to be convicted and removed. So, you know, maybe there was more bipartisanship back then than there is now, but ultimately it was the American people who got upset when Richard Nixon fired Archibald Cox that put pressure on the president to replace that special but not independent prosecutor with Leon Jaworski, who in turn was able to reach out to Republican members of Congress to put pressure on Nixon to end it. So things can be messy, but they do work if the American people are doing their part of the job.
I want to talk as we wrap up about changing norms. The Washington Post looked back at a story in 1970 while Charles Manson was on trial. President Nixon was talking about how, you know, he didn't want Manson to be glorified and remarked that he was, quote, guilty directly or indirectly of 8 murders. There's a big reaction to that. Manson's lawyers moved for a mistrial because of the president's comments. This is kind of a minor scandal. Nixon walked back those statements. So the norm there was saying something pretty clearly true about Charles Manson was stepping over the line. It seems like the norms are very different now with the president being able to tweet directly about cases. Was it worth it to try to fight to bring those norms back?
I would love to bring back a lot of norms. And it's not even actually, you have to go back to 1970. I don't think Barack Obama would have said most of the things that we see said today. So again, I'm not denying the president's right or entitlement to do those things, but it's not as if the norms have gradually changed over the past 50 years. They've rapidly changed over the past half dozen to a dozen years. And, you know, I would love to bring back some of the values of the 20th century. You know, I just don't know how to do that.
We'll leave it there and keep watching. Vikram, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Vikram Amar is dean of the College of Law and a professor at the University of Illinois. He was with us to talk about the sentencing of President Trump's associate Roger Stone today and the limits or lack of limits sometimes of executive power when it comes to federal courts and criminal investigations.